How are your New Year's resolutions going? If you've already given up on them, you're not alone. Researchers have found that most people have abandoned their resolutions and slipped back into old habits by mid-March. In fact, I think January 19th might be the day of peak giving up on it all. So why is it so hard to form good habits, but seemingly so easy to make bad ones? Whether you've resolved to eat better, exercise more, get organised, spend less money, despite the best intentions, we tend to sabotage our efforts by being impulsive, forgetful, or even just a little bit lazy. Some of it does feel like it is active sabotage, doesn't it? These are very human traits, so how can we turn our weaknesses around to work for us? Professor Katie Milkman's devoted her career to the study of behaviour change. She's the author of How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. She's also a professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania and co-directs the Behaviour Change for Good Initiative. Katie, thanks. Welcome to 9 to Noon.
Thanks for having me. Excited to talk.
You could change a lot of lives today because it honestly does feel so hard. And the hint was there, wasn't it? Impulsivity, forgetfulness, fatigue is another thing, isn't it? You get tired and you just lapse back into the old habits. Is it the is it the new year where so many people try and make change? And is that an issue in itself? We're on holiday, life seems easy. Is that part of it all?
Yeah, well, one of the things that's driving our tendency to create New Year's resolutions, besides the social phenomenon, the fact that it's talked about on radio shows like this one, is something that is much broader. It's a tendency whenever we see a change on our calendar, a change in our lives, like a shift to a new community, a shift to a new job, a shift to a new month or a new week, we see an opportunity to start fresh because it feels like a new beginning to us, right? The way we think about time is actually not linear. We think about our lives as if they're divided up into chapters. And whenever we turn the page on a new chapter, it gives us a sense, the old me is behind me, the new me is ahead, they're different. Whatever I failed at before, you know, that was the old me. The new me is going to be all over it. So we've shown in data set after data set that people set more goals at all these new beginnings, not just at New Year's, so the start of a new week, month, following birthdays, following holidays that we associate with fresh starts. People go to the gym more. They set goals about everything from their finances to their health to their education. And in general, I think actually it's very positive that there are all these moments when we have renewed energy to give change a shot. But the problem, as your intro alluded to, is that there's a lot of human frailties working against us. And often we aren't taking the most strategic tact at trying to achieve that change. We just think, okay, it's New Year's, I'm going to do it. I've got this under control. I'm feeling optimistic. And we make the same mistakes we've made before, and we don't actually make the progress we hope to make. And so that's part of the reason that I wrote this book, was actually to try to help lay out some of the science that can help people do this more effectively.
That everything is part of the problem, isn't it? You're not going to be able to change everything at once. This does take mental and emotional energy, so breaking it up is part of it. But is there a benefit in an environment change? Say you've moved to a new city, or you know, left a flat, or left a relationship potentially. Can a new environment be or can it assist with change if you use it the right way?
Yeah, the evidence suggests it can. There's some really wonderful research looking at actually college transfer students and how if they transfer within the same community, so they're still living in the same location, their habits generally don't change nearly as much as transfers who are coming into a new community. They're moving homes and going to a new school. So yes, absolutely. And what we also know is that our environment in many ways shapes our habits. So I'll give you a really concrete example. If I live next door to a donut shop and my habit has become, I you know, figure out what I'm going to have for breakfast every morning, and it's a donut and it's really convenient, and I go and pick up that donut. I've gotten in that habit and I want to cut back on donuts. Well, it's going to be easier for me to cut back on donuts if I move and I no longer live next door to that donut shop than if I now have to break an old routine and resist the temptation every time I'm walking by my old haunt. So the thing that is nice about a clean slate that's physical, a physical change, is some of the triggers that cue you to engage in habitual or bad behaviors. They go away and you have a clean slate to work from.
One more question before I get you to run us through these strategies that are backed by science. The word sabotage was used there. Now, that seems to me, in the introduction, to be a slightly different thing from impulsivity, which is just I want it and I want it now, and that donut shop is right there, forgetfulness or laziness or fatigue, all of which can attack our efforts. Sabotage is a kind of subliminal determination to not make the change. And is that a very real human trait as well? At some level, we know it's going to be hard, or we're going to have to let go of something we like, and so we find a way to wreck that process.
I don't know of research pointing to a subliminal desire to sabotage ourselves. I have not seen evidence of that. I think we accidentally sabotage ourselves because of some of our wiring, the ways that we're evolved to react to different stimuli, the fact that it's in our nature to, for instance, crave instant gratification over long-term rewards and overemphasize that instant gratification. But I wouldn't call that subliminal sabotage so much as some features of human nature that make change harder and that we have to be aware of and actually strategize around in order to succeed.
Okay, just one more sneaky little one. Is it easier to establish a bad habit than a so-called good habit? And if so, why?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually don't believe that is the case. But the problem, the reason that we feel that way, is that a lot of the things that are bad habits, the reason they become bad habits is because they provide instant gratification to us. And a lot of the things that are good for us, unfortunately, don't. And so it can be an uphill battle more. So if you think about things like exercise, that's a habit most of us would like to have, or practicing a meditation habit, or learning a new language. You'd like to have a study habit around that, right? Those things are all things where the rewards you're going to get from your action are mostly delayed. And while you're engaging in the behavior, it might not feel super pleasant unless we take a lot of steps to try to make it different or feel different.
Which you're about to run us through now. So
right.
we're gonna make it before mid-March. We're going to make some of these changes. Give us some of the strategies that come straight from the science or combat some of what we know are our innate traits. Katie?
Yeah, well, let me back up to where you actually started a moment ago, which is you pointed out that it's not great to try to do a million things at once. And that is really important. So if you make 10 New Year's resolutions, you're already setting yourself up for a lot of failure because it's too many things to focus on and it's going to become overwhelming. That's basic common sense, but there's also research showing it. And in particular, one thing that it's really critical to do in order to succeed at your goals is not just to have a big goal like, oh, I'm going to exercise more this year and get in shape, but actually to break that down and make a plan. When will you do it? Where will you do it? How will you get there? Think through those details. You're less likely to forget. You're more committed to it. Putting it off now is not sort of, oh, it's a vague intention, but it's actually you're breaking a specific plan. It's going to be harder to do if you said Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays at 4 p.m., I'll be at this gym. So planning is important, but planning actually undermines goal achievement when you have multiple goals you're planning for. So one thing at a time, make a plan. That's going to be really helpful in terms of increasing commitment, reducing forgetting. And then another hugely important thing that many of us forget to do, and this is related to your question about good habits versus bad habits and the soliloquy I went on around, you know, a lot of the things we want to do that are good for us, they're not that enjoyable in the moment. They give us delayed rewards. That is true, but we actually want to change that equation as much as possible. So there's research showing that most of us think about the most efficient way to get to our end goal. And that's how we design our approach when we're making a plan. So if we're thinking about exercise, you think, what, you know, I want to get in shape. What's the most efficient workout I can do? You know, maybe it's the Stairmaster for 30 minutes a day. I'll do that because that's going to burn a ton of calories. It's going to be great and really compact in terms of time. That's an efficient way to get to my goal. Actually, a small subset of people take a different approach. They actually think about, how do I make it maximally fun to pursue my goal? And what research by Ayelet Fishbach and Caitlin Woolley at the University of Chicago and Cornell has shown is actually if we nudge people, we encourage people to pursue their goals in a way they find more fun rather than the way that's most efficient, you get better results. And that might seem counterintuitive, but the reason is if you're doing the Stairmaster, which isn't that fun, but it's efficient, you don't enjoy it and you quit after, say, one workout. If you are taking a Zumba class with a friend, maybe you're not burning as many calories per workout, but you're actually having a good time and you keep coming back. So net net, you end up with a better result. And this is true with all different types of goals, and it's a common mistake. So a key thing to think about when you're pursuing your goals, how can I make it fun? And a key way I have studied of doing that actually is through something I call temptation bundling, which is there something that you love, that you look forward to, that you crave, that you can actually only allow yourself to enjoy while you are pursuing the goal that would otherwise feel like a chore? So sticking with the gym, there might be a favorite TV show you like to binge watch. What if you only let yourself do that while you're working out? Now, all of a sudden, what felt like a chore is something you look forward to. Time flies while you're exercising. Maybe you also don't feel guilty binge watching the TV show. Maybe you even enjoy both more together. And you can do this with lots of chores, right? The podcast or the radio show you save for enjoyment while you're doing household chores, while you're cooking a fresh meal, you open a fresh bottle, a special bottle of wine. Certain snacks you can only pick up while you're heading to the library to hit the books if you're a student. Lots of ways to temptation bundle. So that's a key way to make it more fun. And let me stop there because I've given you a couple strategies.
No, that's great. And fun can happen in all forms. There was an interesting study or experiment run out of Sweden at a subway station, right, and was trying to get people to use stairs rather than escalators. And not only to manage the crowd, but also for fitness and health, I think. They brought in this little experiment where they turned the stairs into piano keys. So as you walked up them, it played a tune, which is a simple little pleasure, right? A novelty. You see, the human brain loves novelty too, right?
Absolutely. So gamification is one way of making things fun. Novelty like piano stairs that now all of a sudden 66% more people are choosing the stairs over the escalator. Even though the escalator's less work at the end of a long day, the stairs now look enticing. So there are like cute tricks along those lines that you can use. There are strategies like temptation bundling. And then another thing that is key to fun is social. When you do things with other people, you enjoy them more generally. Especially if you choose people you like to do them with. And we've done some research on exercise in particular that people don't appreciate the huge value they get from, for instance, having a workout buddy. They both keep you accountable and change your enjoyment of the experience. And when people are getting paid a dollar every time they go to the gym, they actually work out 35% less than when they're paid a dollar every time they and a friend both show up together, which is harder. That's a harder way to earn a dollar. And yet, we show that it's 35% more effective. So I flipped those statistics. So 35% more exercise when you're paid for going with someone than when you get that pay uncontingent on joining your friend at the gym.
It's really interesting also that spending time around high achievers or perhaps people who have done well at what you're taking on seems to rub off on your own performance. So this is interesting because your first thought is it might become intimidating and, you compare yourself. But is it actually more that you get interested in more of the details and facts and possibilities around your activity, say it's cycling or some other kind of exercise?
Yeah. This is one of my favorite findings is that, the people who we surround ourselves with change our understanding of what is feasible and also how to make it feasible. So, one of the most interesting studies of this just looks at when you're randomly assigned a college roommate who's a bit of a better student, it improves your own grades in college. And what that seems to be driven by is a couple of things. One, right, you see that person studying on Friday nights and Saturday nights, and you're thinking, oh, I guess it's normal to stay in and study, versus you see them going out and partying and you think, oh, I guess it's normal to go out and party. So you emulate the behaviors of the people around you because they strike you as normal. But also you may not just notice when they're studying, but how they're studying and what are the strategies they're using to achieve their goals? And you may be able to copy those too. So they show you what's normal. They show you what's possible. They show you how to achieve it. It is important that they not that the people who you surround yourself with, if it's in service of achieving a goal and you're doing this deliberately, that they not be so far ahead that what you watch them do feels impossible, right? You're a novice, they're an expert, the gap feels impossible to close. It may be demotivating because you could never do what they're doing. But to the extent that they're, you know, relatable and within reach, there are these really nice benefits shown consistently of spending time around people who can show you the way and show you it is feasible to achieve that goal.
Professor Katie Milkman, our guest, devoted her career to the study of behaviour change. The book is How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. I think we touched on cues. Typically, we think of them as a negative sense. It could be you get home and you head straight to the fridge. It could be, as you say, you need that donut shop and you head in. And as you say, that bias we have for immediacy overrules our longer-term goals. How can we flip it and make the cues constructive, make the cues something that moves us towards something? I remember when I was studying while working a few years ago, it was the sound of Coronation Street at 7:30. I just had precisely 2 ginger nuts and a cup of tea, and I took the ginger nuts and the cup of tea into my study and away I went. It was something as basic as that, but it was the cue that said go. And can we build some of those cues in that override the I want to sit here in front of telly immediate reward?
Absolutely. This is part of good planning, is that when you are planning around, okay, this is a behavior I want to start doing regularly, whether it's, you know, you mentioned a cup of tea you want to drink on a regular basis or a food you'd like to make sure is in your diet. For me, I've been trying to learn Spanish on the Duolingo, the language learning app. And it's not just, okay, I'm going to try to do this five minutes a day or 10 minutes a day or 20 minutes a day. That's important in terms of planning. It's actually, well, what's going to trigger the activity? When am I going to do it? And what will it come after? So for me, I've got a 7-year-old and I read him his bedtime story. I tuck him in. And then I do my few minutes of language practice before I get back on email and then figure out what I need to take care of to make sure the next day will go smoothly at work. So, you know, I have some bad habits and some good habits, but there's a trigger. And then every day, that's my routine. We do it with brushing our teeth when we wake up in the morning. And there's so many, and before we go to bed at night, in many cases, there are many other things, though, that you can deliberately tie to a daily activity and say, okay, always right after I brush my teeth, for instance, I will floss. And that combination can be really helpful because it triggers the memory and it ensures that this is something that you're getting, you're doing in a really consistent, practiced way.
What about a penalty clause? We've talked about the rewards, the temptation bundling, so putting something constructive and positive and enjoyable next to something that's going to take a bit of effort. Where and when do penalties fit into the picture?
Yeah, this is great. I'm glad you brought this up because when it comes to things that are where instant gratification is working against us, there's essentially 2 ways to rewire so that you'll be successful, right? Whether it's exercise that's not as fun in the short term and has the long-term rewards, or saving, or practicing your language, meditation. A lot of things have this structure. So one way to change that equation is to make it more fun to engage in the activity in the moment so that now it's not so lopsided. So now you're looking forward to it instead of dreading it, and you're going to get it done. The other way, though, that you can do this is sort of, there's the carrot and the stick. We talked about the carrot. The stick is you create penalties, so, just like we're used to others doing for us to manage our behavior, in order to make it actually so horrendous if you don't achieve the goal that you're going to get it done come, you know, heck or high water. So let me be more concrete about how we're used to seeing this in the world, right? You might have a boss who says, you know, if you don't hit this deadline, there's going to be a major problem, or I'm going to dock your pay. Your performance rewards are going to be reduced this year. You might be used to a state government or any kind of government saying you're going to get a ticket if you speed, right? So there are penalty clauses all around us to manage temptations. That way you're tempted to speed, but oh, nope, I might get a ticket, or I might lose my driver's license. You're tempted to procrastinate and binge watch TV instead of turning in the report, but you realize if you don't get it in by this deadline, your compensation may be docked this year. So we get it done. What's weird about what I'm going to describe, which is called a commitment device, is it's you doing this to yourself. It's self-management instead of someone else managing you. So there are actually a number of different websites that will allow you to put money on the line that you will have to forfeit if you don't later achieve a goal. And you can choose a referee. It can be digital, right? It could be like a step counter or a scale that you weigh in on that sends a digital signal, or another person who can monitor any behavior, and they will let the site know whether or not you've achieved your goal. And interestingly, there's some really wonderful research showing that giving people access to a source where they can create a penalty clause improves outcomes. My favorite research on this actually looks at it in the context of smoking, getting people to help quit smoking. So people who wanted to quit were randomly assigned to either get a standard package of smoking cessation tools, or they were given that standard set of tools and an opportunity to put money in an account that they would have to forfeit if they didn't pass a urine test for nicotine or cotinine 6 months in the future. And lo and behold, the quit rates were 30% higher among those who had a way to put that money on the line and penalize themselves. Now, lots of people chose not to put any money in that bank account, but just having access to it in this random assignment study, that's what increased quit rates by 30%. So imagine if everyone was using these tools, how much more powerful it would be.
Just let's talk about some quick hacks now, because there's moments when we give way and there's some good hacks here. Reminders, for example, if you set your alarm because it's time to go and do something, your studies show that it works when you act on them immediately. As soon as you start drifting and hitting snooze, there's a problem, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Reminders have to be timely. You have to be able to do it right now. So I remind you in my partner in the morning, hey, we need milk. Don't forget to pick it up on the way home. Totally useless, essentially, right? Because it's so long before he would be able to do that. But if I send him a text at 5 o'clock, because I know he's leaving the office, and say, just a reminder, it'd be super helpful if you could grab some milk, and he's literally able to walk into the grocery store right then, now it's a timely reminder. And what we see in study after study is if you can act on the reminder immediately, it really is quite beneficial. If you're going to have to, take the reminder, enter it into your calendar for another reminder that comes up at the right moment, now we're getting into the phase where it's useless.
And the idea of visualization and vivid cues, because again, we're trying to get over that instant moment where there's the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other, so to speak. And can you visualize in that moment? Can you get over that brain tendency to do the easy or the nice thing now with some visualization or with some cues?
Yeah, absolutely. So say you don't know the exact moment when you need to stop by your pharmacy and pick up a prescription, for instance. You know, you need something that's going to remind you to do that, and you can't just put it in your calendar at a specific time. Thinking carefully about something unusual that's likely to catch your eye at a moment that is a good that would be timely. I'm in the city of Philadelphia where we're hoping to win the Super Bowl, which is a major football championship. And there's all these crazy banners up and flags in people's windows. And I know of a particular one near my pharmacy that always catches my eye because it's quite, elaborate. So I could think to myself, okay, when I see that, it's the Eagles team banner that's up in my neighbor's house. That the next time I see that is going to remind me I need to stop at the pharmacy and pick up this prescription. Yeah. And interestingly, that the way memory works, something vivid like that catches your attention, if you can capitalize on that as a cue and tell yourself that's how I'm going to remember, it can be quite effective.
That can also be used for breaking up a run, say, because I know I get to this bit and then I'm trying to get to that bit, and just having those little sort of mini goals within goals by using visualization. Just finally, and this is a really important one, allow for emergencies, because we've all had it. Okay, I've been going along really well, but I did have a Mora bar today, and so I'm going to chuck the whole damn plan out. Or I stayed up late and watched a TV program that I'm supposed to watch when I go to the gym tomorrow because I am doing the bundling thing, the temptation bundling. Is it also a human trait to go, one mistake, ergo, the whole thing's out the window?
Yes. Marketers have named it the what the hell effect, that, you eat the donut at the birthday party at breakfast and then you decide, oh, what the heck? And you, eat terribly for the whole rest of the day. Or this is true with many goals. So to combat that, you want to set tough goals for yourself. Those are the most motivating. But the risk with tough goals is a small goal failure that leads you to go into the cycle of giving up on yourself. Wonderful research by Marissa Sharif at the Wharton School, my colleague, shows that if we set a tough goal, but give ourselves a couple of emergency reserves that we can say, okay, that was an emergency miss. It doesn't count. I'm still on track for, say, running 7 days this week or meditating 7 days this week. You give yourself a limited number, you get better results than if you set the wimpier goal, because people hoard those emergencies. They try not to take them. And yet when they need them, they have the ability to say, hey, that was a mulligan, that was an emergency, I'm still on track. So it's sort of a little mental gymnastics and trick to keep yourself pushing as hard as you can towards a tough stretch goal without giving up on yourself when you have a hiccup.
Katie, thank you. Katie Milkman, Professor Katie Milkman. The book is How to Change the Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be.